Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day three of this Rohatsu Sesshin in December 2017 here at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico on a rather strangely unwintry day. Everything is kind of upside down in the universe these days. There's a lot of intense weather. There's a lot of intense politics. There's a lot of upset. It's a most excellent time to practice. There's no security anywhere, it appears, and there never really is anyway. So when we start getting anxious, what's the best thing to do? And we'll talk about that in a bit. For right now, I'd like to share with you, as usual, as traditionally, the Rohatsu exhortation for the third night of the great Zen Master Hakuin, the Rinzai Zen Master Hakuin, who single-handedly resurrected Rinzai Zen in Japan in the 18th century. This particular night, he is speaking really to the Japanese culture, and it makes sense. He's a Japanese Zen master living in Japan, speaking to Japanese monks. I doubt there was a single foreigner among them. In fact, Japan was quite closed in that era. So it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to we in modern America, but we'll share it anyway, and perhaps there's something you can glean from it. On the third night, the master said, "There are two kinds of bodhisattvas, those who pass on the Dharma lamp, transmitting the eye and treasure of the Buddha's right Dharma from master to disciple without deviation, and those who preserve and protect that Dharma. The relation between them is like that which exists between teacher and student. When complete accord does not exist between teacher and student, the great Dharma cannot, on its own, come into play. When that happens, protecting the Dharma is of greatest importance." Why is it so important to protect the Dharma? Dharma with a capital D, as it is in this writing, means the teachings. And what are the teachings? These are the teachings, these are the experiences and the teachings of the young man, Siddhartha Gautama, who became known as the Buddha, the Awakened One. And it's how to do it. It's our instruction manual for coming to awakening. And if these are lost, it's going to be a lot harder for anyone to learn to do practice or to come to awakening. And for this reason, and also because coming to awakening allows us to become infinitely free, depending on the depth of awakening, it allows us to become infinitely free of hindrances to expressing our innate compassion and wisdom without bounds. Someone who's profoundly enlightened, and there really aren't those in this era at the moment, is someone who is able to naturally behave without any instigation, any requirement, any rules, in a most enlightened way, that is, not creating harm, and being absolutely clear and able to help people in countless ways. Our bodhisattva vow is about relieving suffering, and there is certainly enough of it in the world today. And if that teaching of how to come to awakening is lost, then it's going to be a lot harder. Because there are many superficial ways of relieving suffering. Of course, we can feed people who are hungry. We can do various other things. But a lot of this is really, first of all, coming from a place of me being kind to you, and has a hint of pity in it, and also a tag on it. I want you to be grateful to me for feeding you. It is rare that someone truly gives a gift without any strings attached. One has to be quite let go in their own personal attachments in order to be able to do that. And when we cannot do that without having strings attached to whatever we give to ostensibly relieve suffering, then it is very well likely to create more suffering. But there's a way of going beyond creating suffering, of offering ourselves freely without any attachments, without any strings. And that truly does relieve suffering. In order to be able to do that, we have to let go of those attachments. And that's what our Zazen is for. And that's what the teachings are for. And that's why the teachings are so very precious. Long ago, the great Shingon priest Kukai asked Dainichi, the great Sun Buddha, who is foremost in protecting the Dharma? None can compare with Benzai Ten, replied the Buddha. Although transmitting the Dharma is a primary concern, the Dharma cannot function alone without the means of protecting it. Hence the supremacy given to protectors of the Dharma like Benzai Ten. And Benzai Ten is sort of a transfer from a Hindu god into the Buddhist cosmology. Whenever a new religion comes into a country, it meets with the religions that are already there, and usually has to have some sense of compatibility, at least, with the existing religions in order to survive. And in many cases, we find that there are, for example, there were gods in the early religions, the pre-Buddhist religions of Japan, as well as in other countries. And these gods were transformed into Buddhist deities, protectors of the Dharma. And that way they weren't eliminated from Buddhism. They actually gained an important role. And so they weren't thrown out. And that can be helpful in terms of people feeling an affinity with the new religion. So that's what happened with Benzai Ten. Now, there's a slightly different translation of this. This translation was done by Norman Waddell, who is really the primary translator of Hakuin. It's as if he's Hakuin himself. But there was another translation in which these are spoken of as supporters of the Dharma. This is supporters of our practice. There's those who practice and there are those who support our practice. And both kinds of bodhisattvas are important. Without people helping to support this place, without people helping to build our addition so that we can have more women veterans with PTSD served in our outreach program, our free non-sectarian outreach program. We don't say a thing about Buddhism to the women. This is more about teaching them tools that we have learned ourselves to help them de-stress from their experiences. PTSD is a pretty huge and overwhelming conditioning. And whatever we can do to help relieve the suffering of these women is really important and is part of our bodhisattva vow. But without the help of countless people who may never come to practice here, but here and there make a donation to help keep the place going, it makes a difference. We can keep going. And these are the supporting bodhisattvas. And those of us who sit Zazen here, do Sesshin here, we are the practicing bodhisattvas. and both are necessary, and there's not one that's better than the other. The way of Zazen comprehends all other ways. In the way of the gods, for example, the body is regarded as the condensation of heaven and earth, and heaven and earth as the expansion of the body and mind. Residing within you are seven generations of celestial gods, five of earth gods, and 8 million various other gods as well. According to the Shinto writings, to venerate these gods, you must perform, quote, the divine worship of the excellent ancestors, close quote. And here again, we get a little dose of Shinto teaching. The only way to perform this worship is by practicing Zazen. When you straighten your backbone, fill your cinnabar field with vital energy, that's your hara, that's the tanden, or the area of your belly that's a couple of finger widths below your navel. And sit with your six roots still and quiet, not a single thought impinging on your perceptions. Impinging on your perceptions. This is deep practice. If we can sit with our mind so still that no thought comes forth, which is very different from shutting down thoughts, trying to prevent thoughts, that's a deep form of practice. This is Shikantaza, which is vastly misunderstood in how it's practiced. The only way to perform this worship is by practicing Zazen. When you straighten your backbone, fill your cinnabar field with vital energy, and sit with your six roots still and quiet, this is your eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Not a single thought impinging on your perceptions. You are worshiping all the gods of heaven and earth. Even though you sit like this for only a single stick of incense, the merit of that sitting is by no means a small one. Zen Master Dogen said, a day of religious practice is a priceless treasure. 100 years without that practice are 100 years of regret. Ah, how awesome, how humbling those words are. When you straighten your backbone, we sit upright, relaxed but upright. Fill your cinnabar field with vital energy. In other words, we focus as if our mind were seated in our hara. And sit with your six roots still and quiet. In other words, don't engage in what you're seeing, hearing, thinking, feeling. But stay utterly still and quiet. Open to possibility. Aware, profoundly aware. And yet not entertaining anything that comes before you. Instead, as Fleur Courtois said, at a certain point when she realized that nothing outside was going to work, she sat deeply silent like this. And if something started to come up, she would, without words, say, in essence, not this, not this, and keep looking further, deeper. We have no name, in a way, for what we're looking for, unless we call it our true self, and what does that mean? Our face before our parents were born. The sound of one hand. But what it is so precious and so vital to return to living from fully that we spend our time working towards opening to that mind state. This is practice in a nutshell. Zen Master Dogen said, a day of religious practice is a priceless treasure. 100 years without that practice are 100 years of regret. Ah, how awesome, how humbling those words are. And of course, at the moment we die, How are we going to feel? Are we going to regret not doing more Zazen? Are we going to regret not living a different way of life? Are we going to offer up regret after regret after regret? Or are we going to go as the Zen masters of old have, and some of the modern ones as well, seamlessly, simply not breathing in again, at ease with the transition, no regrets, moving easily along. We have the possibility of going either direction. Yamaruma Roshi's final poem asks for liberating all sentient beings, which of course is the first bodhisattva vow. Just this left to do, letting go everything in the whole universe. Letting go everything in the whole universe. When we allow ourselves to truly let it go, instead of having it, in essence, taken from us, it makes it very different, dying. And what is dying all about? Here we are in December, the end of a year, a time when nature sinks back down to its roots, the leaves falling off the trees, the cold coming, the plants dying back, a kind of death. And many people do die from this physical life during this time. But what happens to us when we die? Where do we go? Do we go? What is it going to be like? Are we going to be anxious? Or are we going to be at ease, allowing this amazing process to unfold? How you meet this is going to depend entirely on you. And of course, the more Zazen you can do, the easier it will be. So I'd like to continue again today with the letters of Dawi. Dawi Zonggao, who was born in the 11th century in China and became an incredible Zen master, and such that his teachings have come down to us to this day in high relief, really. He's one of the more well-known Zen masters, Chan masters, we should really say, because he was Chinese. And every evening when we chant Dae Zenji's vow for awakening, that is Dahui. Dae is how his characters, the Chinese characters that form his name, are pronounced in Japanese. Dae Zenji's vow for awakening. Our vow for awakening, our own vow for awakening, something to consider. So here we have Dawi's second letter to Wang Nehan, whose last name really is Yang Zong. Nehan apparently is his Buddhist name, although Nehan actually refers to, it means an arhat. Irregardless, here is his letter. I hear that you've shut your gates, set aside your social interactions, and deferred all worldly concerns so that you can apply yourself morning and night to the koan I gave you earlier. This is good news indeed. In cultivating your mind this way, make enlightenment your standard. If, losing heart, you say that your natural capacities are inferior and thus seek some other way to gain awakening, this is like being inside the palace and asking where the capital is. When focusing on your koan, ask, who is it? The one who thinks his capacities are inferior. Who is it? The one seeking to gain awakening. Who is it? I'll explain it clearly for your sake, not sparing my words. It is you, Wang Yanzhang, and no one else. There is only one Wang Yanzhang. Where do you find one who practices? One who thinks his capacities are inferior? Or one who seeks enlightenment? Know that these are all just shadows and have nothing to do with the true Wang Yanzhang. So here we are on day three, and it is a day when things like feeling insufficient can come up. That's actually something that can come up a lot for people who are serious about practice. Ironically, for people who are seriously about practice. And of course, it happened to the one who eventually became the Buddha as well, when he was not dissuaded from his practice by visions of earthly delights, nor was he dissuaded from his practice by pain in his knees, his shoulders, his back, everywhere. Then finally, in an attempt to pull him off his practice, the thought came up, "You're not good enough, you can't do this. You don't have the capability for coming to awakening or finding the way out of suffering." And yet he did. And that is something that we also need to remember, because yesterday when we were chanting one of the ancestral lines during the morning sutra service, it was pointed out that each of these people represents a generation of people who was just like us, struggling to come to awakening, and persisted, persevered, and was able to do so, and pass the Dharma along to the next generation, pass those precious instructions along, the teachings. No doubt, any number of them felt insecure, insufficient in their practice. There are many stories about the Zen masters who became quite famous Zen masters, who actually left their monasteries feeling that they just couldn't make the cut. And one of those was Rinzai, who was asked, sort of goaded by the head monk, to ask the master a question. And three times he asked the master that question, and three times the master sort of yelled at him and said, "I spare you 60 blows." And he didn't know what on earth he said. It made no sense to him. He just asked this question. He thought maybe he'd get an answer. And instead, the guy looks like he's gonna whack him. And finally, after the third time, he feels like, I just don't have what it takes to do this practice. Somewhere or something's missing in me. And he decided to leave the temple. But the head monk, who was very sharp, went to the master and warned him of this, and then told Rinzai he needed to say his goodbyes. He needed to properly leave the temple. He couldn't just walk out. He had to say goodbye and do his bows before his master. And so he did, and the master said, "You need to go to this other master. He'll help you out." And so Rinzai went. But of course, in those days, you had to walk a long, long way to get to another temple. And not only that, but these temples were usually isolated up in the mountains. And so he had plenty of time to puzzle over that encounter, those three encounters with the master. And when he reached the next master, he was able finally to come to awakening. And Kyogen, who, same thing, similar story, left. He felt like, well, I'm no good at practice. At least I can go and take care of this tomb of an ancient master that's fallen into disrepair. And so for some years, he just lived at that tomb all by himself, cleaning the area daily. And then one day, when he's sweeping, and an old piece of broken tile hits a bamboo, tock, suddenly he understood and had a deep awakening experience. So it is useless to assume anything about our practice. This is probably the most important part of what I have to say today. Don't assume anything about your practice. Just give yourself single-mindedly to this wordless search. Zen practice is not like anything else we've ever done in our life. We've gone to school for however many years. I think all of us pretty much have gone to college. So we've had probably, 16 years of school? And we have had lots of experience learning facts and putting them back out again in tests and quizzes and exams. And we're pretty good at getting a sense of whether we'll do well or not. But Zen practice is like going blindly in the dark. As Kapla Roshi once said to me, it's like you're stumbling around in an unfamiliar dark room, pitch black dark, banging into the different pieces of furniture that are there, searching for the light switch. And at a given moment, your hand may be right half an inch from the light switch on the wall. And all you'd have to do is move it just a little bit further, and the light would come on. It's like that with practice. And often, actually, the most dark moments come just before we have an awakening experience. So please, don't judge yourself. Just keep searching. Just keep searching. And trust that if you continue to reach beyond, and let go anything external. Ignore things that you're thinking, that you're feeling, that you're seeing, that you're hearing. Don't let yourself be distracted. Now, of course, there's an important aspect to that, and that is if you've got a history of trauma and traumatic images come up, it's important to tune into your body. There's no point in thinking about them or talking to yourself about them, but to feel the energy of that anxiety, that fear, that whatever it is, in your body, ripping through your body, just to feel that. Hang in there. And when it begins to subside because you have actually stayed fully present with it, then to return to the practice. And of course, the sukhan, the extended out-breath, is a vital aspect of the practice. It's sort of your jet skis or your high-speed train or your rocket to the moon, whatever you want to call it. It will get you deeper faster than anything else. But here's something extremely important. This is what you do on the cushion. The extended out-breath in companionship with the yearning to reach that true face, your true home, your true self, whatever you want to call it. You don't have to call it anything. That yearning to know, that openness to possibility, you do that on the cushion. And there are times during the day when, for example, there's a transition, you're about to finish something and you're about to go on to something else. In that transitional moment, again, stop, ground yourself, do one more extended out breath. In this way, your practice will go deeper. However, if you continue the sisokan other than when you're sitting or in those moments of a single out-breath, you're actually putting up a barrier to yourself, between yourself and reality. And that's not what practice is about. When we are not actually sitting on the cushion, when we are in activity, then our practice is about increasingly deep awareness. And with that, not taking at face value anything we see or hear or think, but searching for the deepest truth beyond it. One day at Sogenji during a tea, Haruta Roshi was asked by one of his Western students, "Roshi, I live in a monastery. I have students. I have a daily schedule. I have this computer that's always asking me to do things on it. And I increasingly get stressed out during the day. But you have a million things to do too. How do you keep from getting stressed?" And Roshi's response was, "When I am doing something, I'm just doing that. I'm not thinking what I had done previously. I'm not thinking what I have to do next. I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just doing what is before me that needs to be done. And when that is done, that's gone. And I'm not keeping it in my mind. I'm moving on to what I have to do next. And that is the only thing in my universe. The rest is gone. Past and present and future are no longer there, and for that matter, no present either. There's just the doing of what needs to be done in that moment. This is deep practice." So the sisokan is a tool. It's a very important tool. And it has a tremendous benefit when we use it appropriately. But it can also, like many tools, be used in the wrong way. And it's important to recognize that. Now, when we use it as it's meant to be used, as a way of really focusing us, allowing us to move deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper as we're sitting on the cushion, it's tremendously effective when combined with that needing to know, needing to return, openness to possibility. But the practice in action is to be so totally aware that there's nobody doing the practice. And if we try to insert sisokan in that, what we're doing is putting up a wall of sisokan between us and what we're trying to do. And we're not really focusing on either one. So, doesn't seem like we need to have much more said here today. The most important thing is to dive more deeply into the practice. This is the Rohatsu Sesshin. This is the Sesshin in the year where countless people throughout the world are sitting along with us, working to open to their innate nature the most profound truth of the universe, and to become free to live their innate compassion and wisdom, to let go where they're caught, so that they can freely work to relieve suffering in the world. So I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.